I'm William Cooper, and you're listening to the Hour of the Time. We're going to go to Phoenix before we start our program tonight. Where Gene is going to tell us the metal report. Good evening, Gene.
Bill, how are you doing tonight?
Good. Did I wake you up?
No, I'm awake. I was asleep last week, but I'm awake tonight.
What's happening, my friend?
Well, the market was fairly quiet today. Gold had a high today of 386.40 and a low of 383.80 to close at 384.90, down $1.40. Silver was $5 up, a high of 531 and a low of 522 to close at 525, down 4 cents. Platinum had a high of 399.90 and a low of 397.60 to close at 399.90, up $1.10. And Dow had a high of 3,700, a low of 3,661.50 to close at 3,667, down $2.60. The big news, as probably most of you are well aware of, is what's going on with the dollar in comparison to foreign currencies. Now, some of you say, well, I don't care what the dollar is compared to the Japanese yen. It doesn't make any difference to me.
Little do they know.
Little do they know, because the farther that thing goes down, well, it may not make any difference to you now, but when you go to buy something, say an electronic item or something, Japanese item, you're going to find out it's going to cost you 25% more because they're going to have to raise up the price to keep in line with where the dollar's going. The weaker the dollar goes, the greater the trade deficit becomes, and I guess you must like your money in a dying machine. But President Clinton says there's nothing to worry about. Funny thing is, if that's true, why did Essex Management, who manages his blind trust, put his million-dollar blind trust by, you know, the guy who's running it, his name is Joseph McNay, and he put his blind trust, $1 million of it, in gold? Gee, are they telling us, do they know something that they're not telling us? Or are they telling us something that is not really the truth?
Well, not only will the cost of foreign goods go up, but the price of our exports will go down accordingly. In other words, we're not going to get the same for our efforts that we export to foreign countries than we have in the past.
That's right. So then it becomes a catch-22. What do they do? Well, they're going to have to, do they let it keep falling? Do they raise interest rates? They raise interest rates, then we go into an inflationary cycle here in our stuff. So it's a two-edged sword that is not very pretty at all. And folks, for goodness sakes, you need to get yourself protected in some fashion, and we'll be more than happy to at least give you some ideas. I have a new newsletter out that most of you have gotten, Malfunction Junction, and it's probably one of our better ones of late. Give us a call, 1-800-289-2646, 1-800-BUY-COINS, and we'll be glad to get that out to you.
And the first caller, folks, gets to babysit Jonathan for one full week.
There you go.
How is he?
He's doing great.
Good.
He's doing great. He's, I don't know. How much time do you got tonight, Bill?
I understand perfectly. Thank you, Gene.
Thank you.
And, folks, call now, 1-800-289-2646. You'll be glad you did. Make sure you have pen and paper tonight for tonight, folks. We'll make history.
woman. Your money's brand new and expensive. Could have been saved for the poor. Why has it been wasted? We could have raised maybe 300 silver pieces or more. People who are hungry, people who are starving, matter more than your faith and pride.
Try not to get worried, try not to turn on to problems that upset you. Oh, don't you know everything's all right? Yes, everything's fine, and we want you to sleep well tonight. Let the world come without you tonight. If we try,
you're not saying we have the resources to save the poor from their lot. There will be poor always pathetically struggling. Look at the good things you've got. Think while you still have me, move while you still see me. You'll be lost. You'll be so, so sorry. When I'm not.
In December 1985, then FBI Director William Webster, speaking at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., admitted that a Jewish underground had emerged as a serious threat to the United States during the preceding 12 months. Indeed, ladies and gentlemen, he was partially right. For over the course of 1985, the Jewish Defense League, known as the JDL, had been responsible for a string of sophisticated bombings that left 2 people dead, a dozen others seriously wounded, and caused millions of dollars in property damage. Alex Oda, the head of the California branch of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, or AADC, had been killed when a bomb went off at the group's Santa Ana office. 7 other people were hospitalized in the attack. Shirim Subzokov, a victim of the Justice Department's Nazi Hunting Office of Special Investigations, or OSI, had also died when a booby-trap bomb blew up in his home in Paterson, New Jersey. A Boston police officer responding to a JDL bomb threat at the local office of AADC was crippled for life when a pipe bomb blew up as he was attempting to defuse it. Jewish underground? No. Another terrorist arm of B'nai B'rith and the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League? Absolutely yes. all controlled from the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. In each of these instances, the bomb attacks had been preceded by noisy public demonstrations and inflammatory press statements by Mordecai Levy, the leader of a JDL splinter group, the Jewish Defense Organization, or JDO. Although FBI boss Webster left his National Press Club audience with the impression that the so-called Jewish Underground was a mysterious and amorphous outfit about which the FBI had little information, in truth, the Bureau had an exhaustive profile of all of the key personnel and their mode of operation. FBI agents on the scene of the Santa Ana, California murder of Alex Oda knew the identities of the three men who planted the bomb before Oda's body was even removed from the murder scene. You never knew any of this, did you? The killers were longtime Jewish Defense League members Andy Green, Keith Fuchs, and Bob Manning. The American-born trio were residents of an Israeli kibbutz in the occupied territories called Kiryat Arba. Kiryat Arba was a training camp and safe house for the JDL and its Israeli affiliate, the Kach Party, spelled K-A-C-H. The FBI, ladies and gentlemen, listed Fuchs, Green, and Manning as suspects in a total of 25 terrorist attacks inside the United States. But you see, most of you sheeple never even knew that there had been terrorist attacks inside the United States until a bomb went off in the World Trade Center in New York City. And then you knew about it only because it furthered the cause of worldwide Zionism, and it was blamed upon a group of Arabs who had direct ties to the Central Intelligence Agency. Fuchs had been jailed in Israel in 1983 for firing a Soviet-made AK-47 rifle at a busload of Arabs on the West Bank. Manning had served time in jail in the United States for bombing the home of an Arab-American activist. When the three JDLers arrived in Los Angeles several days before the Oda murder, they were already under FBI surveillance. But as so often happens with the FBI, they didn't prevent anything. It's no wonder that FBI Director Webster was not anxious to discuss details with the room full of reporters at the National Press Club, for unlike this reporter on the hour of the time, he was afraid. The Bureau had been in a position to prevent the bombing of the Santa Ana AADC office, and as they have in many, many instances, they either flubbed it or allowed it to happen because it furthered their own aims. Or worse. At the same time that the Jewish Underground was conducting its bombing spree from coast to coast, the FBI was relying increasingly on the ADL for information about extremist groups inside the United States of America. This was the same ADL that would join with the KGB, and the East German Stasi in covering the trail of the assassins of Sweden's head of state, Olof Palme, which we'll cover. You can bet your boots we'll cover it. Even more to the point, this was the same ADL that was instrumental in the creation and deployment of such diverse terrorist groups as the JDL and, yes, ladies and gentlemen, the Ku Klux Klan. For how can they keep the Jews together in their own created ghettos to further the political aims of international socialism, also known as Zionism, if they don't present the Jews with a common enemy? All the rest of us, under the guise of the Ku Klux Klan, the skinheads, the white Aryan nation, anti-Semitism. Oh yes, you're going to learn things tonight you never dreamed were happening in this country, the land of the free and the home of the brave. Turns out to be the Liars Club. According to Robert Friedman, the biographer of JDL founder Rabbi Meir Kahane, the militant Jewish group was controlled from its founding days by a secret three-person committee made up of future Israeli Prime Minister and Mossad Operations Chief Yitzhak Shamir, an Israeli parliamentarian Gayla Cohen, and Brooklyn ADL Chairman Bernard Deutsch, whom we've already discussed on earlier programs. It was at a December 1969 meeting between Cohen and Kahani arranged by Deutsch that the JDL launched its campaign of terror and intimidation against Soviet diplomats in New York and Washington aimed at forcing the Soviets to loosen up their immigration laws for Jews. In the early days, before JDL head Kahani hooked up with mobster Joe Colombo and many JDLers began funding their terrorist operations by selling dope, are running syndicate shakedown operations, are performing hits through their Murder Incorporated branch, ADL man Deutsch had been the money bags behind the Jewish militants. Deutsch's involvement with the JDL was such a well-kept secret that his Kahani links remained virtually unknown until 1991. Just as the secret society, the branch of the Illuminati known as B'nai B'rith, had quietly steered other Jewish American groups to smuggle arms into Russia on the eve of the Bolshevik Revolution, the ADL ran the Jewish underground from behind the scenes, often going through the motions of publicly denouncing the JDL violence to make sure that no direct links were ever surfaced. And these Jews were used the same as Ollie North was used. By making them think that they were performing acts of patriotism to protect the Jewish community as a whole, to further the security of the state of Israel. Well, I want to ask you, if you're a Jew and you're listening to this broadcast, if you put the state of Israel above the United States of America, go to Israel and stay there, live there, fight there. And if you have to, die there. Make your dream come true there. This is the United States of America. And if you're an American, I don't care what else you call yourself, you owe your allegiance to America, to the Constitution and to the Bill of Rights. You see, you're being used to help this great nation. The only nation in your history that gave you sustenance, gave you protection, allowed you to prosper. You look around and you see anti-Semitism everywhere where it is not, does not exist here, except within less than 1/1000th of 1% of the population, it is negligible. But if you continue in the path that you are going, you will create a wave of anti-Semitism that will destroy you. Mordecai Levy, the leader of the JDL splinter group that managed to show up on the doorsteps of Alex Oda and Shirim Subzakov on the eves of their assassinations, maintained direct and frequent contact with the ADL's fact-finding division head, Erwin Sewell. Just 2 weeks before the AADC's Washington, D.C. office was blown up on November 29, 1985, Levy had appeared as the featured speaker at a press conference hosted by the Federation of Jewish Organizations of Greater Washington, an umbrella group led by both the ADL and B'nai B'rith, to present a list of enemies of the Jewish people. AADC was among the groups listed. On more than one occasion, Levy's provocateur antics nearly exposed the ADL's hand in fomenting domestic violence, ladies and gentlemen, and here's the truth of how these people operate, and here's the truth of anti-Semitism in America, and here's the truth of swastikas painted on synagogues and on the headstones in Jewish cemeteries. This is the truth, and you'd better listen. And you'd better stop being afraid of these people, and you'd better stop being afraid of being called anti-Semitic. And you'd better point to these traitors and these terrorists and these scum and call them what they are. On February the 16th, 1979, Levy, using the pseudonym James Gutman, filed an application with the United States Park Service in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to obtain permission to hold a rally. Now remember, this is Levy using the pseudonym James Gutman, a German name, I wonder why he did that. Well, you're going to find out. The rally permit, ladies and gentlemen, sought by Levy, a member of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, supposedly existing for the protection of Jews. The rally permit sought by Levy, also known as Gutman on this occasion, was not filed in the name of the JDL, which he was also a member of. Levy was posing as a leader of the American Nazi Party. Levy was posing as a leader of the American Nazi Party, seeking a permit for a Ku Klux Klan and Nazi Party rally at Independence Hall, the site of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Remember, I told you about the Hegelian method of political conflict resolution. Remember, I told you there's no such thing as a patriot community. Remember, I told you that these people who are bringing about the New World Order control both sides of every issue. Indeed, they create the issues. According to the rally permit, Levy was planning a white power rally to show white masses unity of white race and to show the world niggers and Jews are cowards. Among the paraphernalia Levy listed on the application were swastikas, banners, Nazi uniforms, KKK paraphernalia, Will Burn Cross, swastika picket signs saying Hitler was right, gas commie Jews. Verbatim, quote, working out of the Philadelphia offices of the Jewish Defense League, Levy organized local chapters of the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan, and neo-Nazi groups to attend the Independence Hall rally. And these racist fools, not knowing that he was a Jewish member of the ADL and the JDL, fell right into line and did his bidding. Like the little puppet jerks that they are. In the case of the Trenton, New Jersey, Ku Klux Klan, Levy had an inside track. Listen to this. James Rosenberg, also known as Jimmy Mitchell and Jimmy Anderson, a full-time paid employee of the Anti-Defamation League fact-finding division, had successfully infiltrated the local chapter of the Klan. Rosenberg had recently attempted unsuccessfully to get some of the local KKKers to blow up the Trenton headquarters of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP. At the same time he was posing as James Gutman, neo-Nazi, Levy was also mobilizing the Jewish community and every ragtag left-wing socialist Nazi. And that's exactly what they are. For Nazis are really left-wing, ladies and gentlemen. Radical group in the greater Philadelphia area to attend a mass demonstration to confront the Ku Klux Klan and Nazis at Independence Hall. You see, if they all really knew the definition of these terms that they banner about, they'd join forces and they'd be a lot stronger. Oh, the world is full of fools. I sit back and I watch all of this. And I alternately laugh and cry and laugh and cry. All the ingredients, ladies and gentlemen, were there for a serious, very serious rite. A riot brought about in its entirety by the Anti-Defamation League and the Jewish Defense League, organizing and manipulating both sides, filing for the permit, urging violence, attempting to get people to blow up a bridge. But fortunately, ladies and gentlemen, this was one time, the word of Levy's scam on the Park Service leaked out to the Philadelphia press after one Philadelphia newspaper ran a banner headline saying, quote, Nazi rally rouser really Jewish, end quote. And you can check on it yourself, by the way. The Park Service yanked the permit. Levy's Anti-Defamation League handlers ordered him to lay low for a while. I wonder why. After all, there was no need to jeopardize Levy or even Rosenberg's standing as professional agents provocateur inside the racist element of the 1/1000th of 1% of the population of this country who aren't even half as dangerous as these ADL, JDL terrorist agents of a foreign nation spying on American people, blowing up organizations and offices and killing and maiming people in the United States of America. None of you even knew about it. The ADL, of course, had plenty of other aces up their sleeves, and not all of them were Jewish infiltrators. And remember, ladies and gentlemen, the ADL and the JDL and B'nai B'rith are not the Jews. It is a branch, the Jewish branch, of the ages-old Illuminati, controlled by the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. And out of all the Jews in this country, only a handful belonged. One of the most shocking instances of racist violence during the civil rights battles in the South of the United States during the 1960s was the execution-style murders of three civil rights workers in Philadelphia, Mississippi in 1964. And now you're going to hear what really happened. The murders of Andrew Goodman, Robert Cheney, and Mitchell Schwerner sent shockwaves across America and the world as many people began to realize for the first time that the Confederacy, far from being dead, was very much alive and very much committed to rolling back the tide of equal rights for all races, at least in the Deep South. True to its historical roots in the southern jurisdiction of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry and in the original Confederate secessionist plot, the Anti-Defamation League, contrary to its own published propaganda, and that's exactly what it is, propaganda, lined up squarely with the Klan, the Ku Klux Klan, where it counted the most, with its checkbook. One particularly sordid instance of collusion between the Anti-Defamation League and the Ku Klux Klan came to light in a hail of bullets on the night of June 30th, 1968, in Meridian, Mississippi, outside the home of ADL official Meyer Davidson. When the smoke cleared, a local school teacher named Kathy Ainsworth lay dead, and a second man, Thomas A. Terrans III, lay dying. After being hit with over 70 bullets, ladies and gentlemen, fired by 22 local police and FBI agents. Shades of Waco. Miraculously, Terrans survived the attack. Terrans and Ainsworth, both local Ku Klux Klan members, had been set up. They went to Davidson's home, ladies and gentlemen, that night to plant a bomb on his doorstep, not knowing that the leader of their own Ku Klux Klan chapter had betrayed them, and that a small army of police and FBI sharpshooters was waiting in the bushes to ambush them. Right after this short break, I'll tell you who planned it and who brought it about.
Riot!
still continue. The rocks and stones themselves would start to sing.
Hosanna, hey, Hosanna, 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 ho. Hosanna, hey, Hosanna, Hosanna.
Thank you, DJ, see what you find for me.
Hosanna, Hosanna, hey, to the star.
Sing me your songs, but not for me alone. Sing them for yourselves, for you are blessed. There is not one of you who cannot win the kingdom. The slow, the suffering, the quick, the dead.
The entire affair, ladies and gentlemen, had been staged by the Anti-Defamation League. That's right. The entire affair had been staged by the Anti-Defamation League, the agent provocateur inside the local Ku Klux Klan chapter who set up Terrence and Ainsworth, was one of the killers of Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner. Alton Wayne Roberts was out on bail awaiting his trial along with six other members of the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan for the Philadelphia, Mississippi murders when in the early spring of 1968 he cut a deal with the Anti-Defamation League's regional director, Adolph Botnick. The New Orleans-based Botnick had been a long-standing friend of the late Guy Bannister. Guy Bannister. Kennedy assassination. The former FBI special agent implicated by District Attorney Jim Garrison in the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Botnick, with the blessings of Meridian-based FBI special agent Frank Watts and Meridian police detective Luke Scarborough, agreed to pay Alton Wayne Roberts and his brother, Raymond Roberts, $69,000 to become the League's paid agents provocateur. $25,000 in unmarked $20 bills was hand-delivered from New Orleans to the Roberts brothers just days before the Ainsworth-Terrence ambushed. At the time the deal was struck, the White Knights, led by the two Roberts brothers, had been on a nine-month bombing spree, and you thought poor old David Koresh was a bad guy. You stupid sheeple. You need to be sheared. You need to be led to the slaughter. You need your asses kicked. You need to wake up quick. You wonder why I get angry behind this microphone. Sometimes I wonder why I'm behind this microphone. A nine-month bombing spree. The brothers were prime suspects in 10 separate acts of racist violence. In addition to the Philadelphia murders, three of these attacks were directed against synagogues and Jewish leaders in Mississippi. Do you understand, folks? It's not the Jews. The Jews are being lied to. They're being manipulated just like all of you are. Are you beginning to understand how it works? Three of these attacks were directed against synagogues and Jewish leaders in Mississippi. And they huddled in their little self-made ghettos and pointed their fingers at the community, had nothing to do with it, and yelled, "Anti-Semitism, the Nazis are coming to get us." And you're so proud of your level of education. You should be ashamed of yourselves, all of you. The Roberts brothers, as per their deal with Botnick, ordered two of their Klan underlings to deliver the bomb to Davidson's home. They then tipped off the FBI and the local police about the exact time the attack would occur. In return for their continuing services to the ADL after the Davidson incident, the brothers were given slap-on-the-wrist sentences and placed in the FBI's witness protection program. And for his part in the Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner murders, Alton Wayne Roberts spent less than 3 years in jail and is again very active with you-know-who. The Meridian incident was classic Anti-Defamation League, classic Hegelian conflict method of political resolution. The League used the racist attack against Meyer Davidson as a scare tactic fundraising ploy. And the Jews filled their coffers, emptied their pockets, and asked the same people who had attacked them to protect them, using their own money. The money they raised more than covered the costs of buying up the two KKKers as their permanent agents provocateur inside the Klan. The League parlayed their financing of the Roberts brothers into an ever closer relationship with the FBI, which was delighted to have the ADL finance and deploy two of the Klan's most violent terrorists. When you begin to study the Waco massacre, you'll find that David Koresh spent time in Israel, that he and some of his fathers were trained by the JDL in infantry tactics, that he attended classes on the Talmud, that he was surrounded by Mossad and ADL agents and JDL personnel. You will find that the original reports from the foreign source quoted in the first press report that they were going to commit mass suicide came from prominent ADL members in Australia. You people better wake up. You better do it fast. Koresh in the Hebrew language means Cyrus. David, of course, the house of David, the famous king of Israel. Cyrus was the one who freed the Jews from Babylonian captivity. David, Koresh, flew the Star of David on the flagpole above what was called Mount Carmel. He claimed that he held the keys to the seven seals in the book of Revelation. Poor, brainwashed, mind-controlled, manipulated David Koresh. On the day in November 1985 that Israel spy Jonathan J. Pollard was arrested, things went haywire at the Anti-Defamation League's headquarters near United Nations Plaza in New York City. National Chairman Kenneth Baelken immediately flew off to Israel to assess the damage and to make arrangements for the appropriate American attorneys to be brought in to represent not only the jailed spy but the other more senior players in the nominally Israeli spy ring. Were you aware that the headquarters of B'nai B'rith and the ADL is in the same building occupied by the Trilateral Commission? Among the most important of those senior players was Colonel Aviam Sella, an Israeli Air Force war hero who had been Pollard's recruiter on behalf of the secret Israeli techno-spy unit, Lekim. Sella's cover for his spy recruiting was that he was in the United States taking graduate courses at New York University, and Sella's wife Ruth, a practicing attorney, reportedly was working on the staff of the ADL's legal department while the couple lived in New York. Any published links between the ADL and the Pollard spy apparatus could naturally prove very, very damaging, especially in light of the cozy relationship the League was enjoying with the Reagan White House at the time. You see, while still in Israel, Bailkin telephoned fellow ADL man Leonard Garment of the politically powerful law firm of Dickstein Shapiro. Garment was then the personal lawyer for United States Attorney General Edwin Meese. He agreed at Bailkin's urging to represent Sella in the Pollard matter, despite the obvious severe conflict of interest. What an understatement. At the ADL's Washington, D.C. office, Myra Lansky Boland, was also undoubtedly worried that her own links to Pollard might surface. Lansky Boland had been a classmate and pal of Pollard at the graduate school program in National Security Affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy of Tufts University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Upon graduation in 1978, both Lansky and Pollard had been immediately placed into sensitive posts in the United States intelligence community. Pollard had gone into naval intelligence, my old alma mater, and had almost immediately begun funneling secrets to Israel. Lansky Boland had gone to work for the Central Intelligence Agency, and after a two-year stint with the CIA, she had transferred to the Pentagon, where she worked under Dr. Andrew Marshall at the Office of Net Assessments, a little-known but very, very powerful unit that prepared technical assessments of Soviet military capabilities. In 1982, Lansky had left the government to work full-time for the ADL in Washington. Now, don't even believe that she ever left anything. Shortly after her arrival at the ADL from the Pentagon, she was assigned as the case officer on the League's multi-million-dollar campaign to smear and jail Lyndon LaRouche and scores of his associates for naming the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, B'nai B'rith, and the ADL in the attempts to destroy the United States of America. Now, don't get me wrong, folks. I am not for Lyndon LaRouche. He's a screaming socialist himself, masquerading as a conservative. But nevertheless, he has brought out a lot of truth about a lot of things, and he was framed and wrongfully imprisoned, all brought about by the ADL. Following the Pollard arrest, Andrew Marshall would be identified, ladies and gentlemen, as a suspected senior member of the Pollard spy ring, although no charges were ever brought against him, and he remains to this day in his post at the Defense Department. To this day, Pentagon officials have never succeeded in pinning down the identity of the Mr. X who gave Pollard the code numbers of the classified documents that the naval intelligence analyst then stole and passed on to Lekim. Both Pollard and Lansky had gotten their government spy jobs courtesy of Fletcher School professor Yuri Ra'anan. Ra'anan, an Oxford University-trained Middle East expert, had himself been an Israeli government intelligence operative of the Mossad, posted in New York City and Washington during the 1950s and 60s, and also an operative of British intelligence. He was playing all ends against the middle. While serving as a press attaché at the Israeli embassy in Washington in the mid-1960s, Ra'anan had helped set up a unit that would recruit Israeli spies from the ranks of American businessmen traveling frequently to the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. That spy unit, which was unearthed in a series of civil suits beginning in 1967, all on record, was housed at the headquarters of the B'nai B'rith International. Ra'anan's contact point inside the B'nai B'rith was Philip Klutznik, an honorary national chairman of the ADL who would later serve as President Jimmy Carter's Secretary of Commerce. Among the damage control efforts launched by the ADL in the wake of the Pollard arrest was the planting of a string of news accounts and editorials portraying Pollard as a loyal American who was also committed to the security of the state of Israel. No such thing, folks. A loyal American is devoted to the United States of America. Citizens of the state of Israel are devoted to the state of Israel, and stupid fools who are allowed to be manipulated thinking that they owe allegiance to both. I have nothing against Israel, but Israel needs to take off its diaper and stand on its own two feet. Harmless, friendly espionage was the term coined by the League and its small army of paid agents inside the news media. Bullshit. Unfortunately, Pollard's spying was anything but harmless or friendly. The Lekim unit, headed by the former chief of European operations for the Mossad, Rafael Dirty Rafi Eitan, was passing on the most sensitive of the American national security secrets heisted by Pollard to the Soviet KGB. In return, Moscow was opening up the pipeline of Soviet Jews to Israel. It was treachery of the highest order, and then Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger was fully aware of the magnitude of Pollard's crimes when he asked the judge to sentence Pollard to life in prison after the spy agreed to plead guilty. He should have been executed. In a 46-page classified affidavit submitted to the judge in the Pollard case, Weinberger showed that much of the Pollard material wound up in Soviet hands and that it would cost the United States billions of dollars to repair the national security damage done by the Pollard spy ring. The ADL is not a friend of the United States of America. The JDL is not a friend of the United States of America. B'nai B'rith is not a friend of the United States of America. The Scottish Rite of Freemasonry is not a friend of the United States of America. Israel is not a friend of the United States of America. In fact, ladies and gentlemen, the millions of pages of classified documents funneled by Pollard to the KGB, a majority were of no critical interest to Israel at all. Did Kenneth Bailkin or Myra Lansky Bullard or any of the other ADL officials who abetted Pollard in his spy work know that the pilfered material was going to the KGB? The answer to that question has never been made public to this day. Only the players in the espionage operation know for sure. But I believe that they knew 100% what was happening and where it was going every single moment that they were a part of it. And remember, folks, they organized it. They put it together. And they controlled it. It is unquestionably the case that at the same time the ADL was knee-deep in the Pollard stew, top ADL officials were working hand-in-glove with the Soviet bloc intelligence services on several other projects that would have devastating consequences for the United States of America. You see, the ADL are traitors, murderers, terrorists, and scum, and has nothing to do with Jews. They use Jews, and they use you because you're so afraid of being called anti-Semitic if you tell the truth about these scumbags. You quiver just thinking about somebody calling you anti-Semitic. Well, take it from me, folks. It don't hurt at all. Not at all. I've never been anti-Semitic in my life, but in their efforts to shut me up, they have tried on several occasions to brand me as an anti-Semite, and it doesn't work, and it doesn't shut me up, and I'm not afraid of them. And if I end up dead, I've already told you what to do. You take my dead, cold body, and you place it up on the steps of the Supreme Council of the Scottish Rite of the Southern Jurisdiction in Washington, D.C., and then you burn it to the ground. And then you do the same to B'nai B'rith and all the other lodges of these scumbag traitors in this country. If I turn up dead, you do that. It's the only thing I'll ever ask of you except to wake up. One such ADL friend of Moscow was Whiskey Baron Edgar Bronfman. Edgar Bronfman Remember, we discussed him on an earlier episode of the ADL Exposé. The third-generation Bronfmans had successfully transformed their father's Prohibition-era bootlegging business into a legitimate whiskey empire called Seagram's. And every time you take a drink of Seagram's, no matter what it is, you are furthering the goals of B'nai B'rith, the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, and the ADL. And you're helping to destroy this country. Don't drink anything that Seagram's bottles ever. This transformation, ladies and gentlemen, had been aided early on by the United States Treasury Department, which cut a deal with Sam and Abe Bronfman in the close of Prohibition, enabling them to pay several million dollars in back taxes in return for a whitewashing of their decade of big-time crimes. See, they used it as blackmail, just as they caused Elizabeth Clare Prophet and the Church Universal Triumphant to get down on their knees and beg for mercy and give up their guns. All their guns, personal guns, guns of all the members had to be given away. They sold out. They sold America down the tubes. They sold out the Second Amendment. And the Treasury Department cut a deal and made sure that Sam and Abe Bronfman didn't go to jail if they paid several million dollars in back taxes and made them legitimate crooks. The Bronfman family came out of the deal as multi-millionaires with all their ties to the Lansky Syndicate still intact and their criminal record behind them, because they made a deal with the same people that were bowing down to the fire in Waco, Texas. Abner Longy Zwillman was not the only Prohibition-era gangster who profited from the old saw, quote, from rags to rackets to riches to respectability, end quote. By the 1950s, the Bronfman's image had been so cleaned up that Edgar could marry into the Our Crowd Loeb family, and his sister Phyllis could marry Jean Lambert of the Belgian branch of the Rothschild clan. The Lambert family was the European connection in Drexel Burnham Lambert. Ever hear of that? Drexel Burnham Lambert? However, image polishing is one thing. Reality is another. You see, as late as 1972, the Montreal, Canada Crime Commission had issued a report naming Mitchell Bronfman as a crime partner of one of the city's biggest gangsters, Willie Obrunt. The pair were implicated in dope smuggling. Willie and Mitchell owned a night spot in the middle of Meyer Lansky's turf in North Miami called the Pagoda North, which was a favorite hangout for Vito Genovese and other big-time hoodlums. Edgar Bronfman, for his part, sought out some very peculiar clientele for his family's whiskey business. In 1986, as the Pollard affair was playing out, one of Edgar Bronfman's assistants at the World Jewish Congress, Bronfman had taken over the World Jewish Congress and turned it into an international arm of the ADL. That's the ADL, on whose national commission he sits, and established ties to the brutal communist regime in East Germany. Bronfman Seagram was made the exclusive distributor of booze to East Germany's ruling SED Communist Party. In 1988, Edgar Bronfman himself traveled to East Berlin, where he was the guest of honor of SED boss Erich Honecker and top party official Hermann Axen. Makes me sick. I don't know about you. On that trip, Bronfman vowed that he would personally arrange for the East German leader to make a state visit to Washington, D.C. to meet with President Ronald Reagan. Even 1 year later, with the Berlin Wall and East German communism about to collapse, Edgar Bronfman was back in East Germany again, this time promising to marshal the resources of the World Jewish Congress and the ADL to block the reunification of Germany, which he dubbed a sellout of socialism. And that is the truth of the ADL, the B'nai B'rith, and the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. Socialism. And that's where this country is going on a roller coaster unless you stupid sheeple stand up on your hind feet, take the wool off from in front of your eyes, and become real people. In return for those efforts, Bronfman was given the highest civilian award offered by East Germany, the People's Friendship Medal in gold, to this traitor. Edgar's brother and business partner Charles was also a true friend of the Honecker dictatorship as the head of the Canadian East German Friendship Society. He was able to control all passports and visas between the two countries, but there was much more to the Bronfman East Germany liaison than a lucrative whiskey contract and a few medals, and we'll talk about that tomorrow night. Good night, and God bless you all.
A few hours, three times will deny me, and that's not all I see. One of you here dining, one of my 12 chosen, will leave to betray me.
Out of dramatics, you know very well.
Why don't you go do it?
Do I make to do it?
Hurry, they are waiting.
You knew why I do it.
I don't care why you do it.
They'll think I admire you.
For now, I despise you.
You liar.
Judas
wants me to do it. What if I just stayed here and ruined your ambition? Christ, you deserve it.
Hurry, you fool, hurry and go. Save me your speeches, I don't want to know.
Stop!
Look at all my trials and tribulations. Thinking in a gentle pool of wine. But that is a prayer.
Man, see where you thought to our ideal die around us, and it's all because of you. I'm not a dare at all of us. Someone has to turn you in like a common criminal, like a wounded animal. A jaded mandarin, a jaded mandarin, and a jaded, jaded, faded, jaded, jaded mandarin.
Get out to waiting. They're waiting. Oh, they're waiting for you.
Every time I look at you, I don't understand why you love the things you did. Get down to hell. Do that man, it's better if you'd have.